The comment letter we received did have some suggested metrics that ought to be disclosed. And we had some discussion about that, and we chose not to include them in our report. And I think the reason why we did so, and I think this is extremely important in terms of the discussion here at the SAG and then whatever the board chooses to do, the reason we did so was not because we as a committee had any doubt that we thought that some disclosure of additional data that could be used in a competitive process was needed. Now, the report says, the language of the report does leave the possibility open that the PCAOB might find upon close examination that this is an impractical recommendation. But that was not the view of the subcommittee. We unanimously felt that there ought to be, that there are metrics that are worth disclosing and that they can be done in a productive way. We did not wish to impose upon the board what those metrics should be or exactly how to do it. We felt that was something best left to this process that we begin here today. That being said, I think that there are three models that potentially that we ought to consider today as possibilities, and maybe more than three, but there are three that I've been able to think of, and that the board ought to consider going forward after our discussions. The first model is, I think, what the individual who wrote to us and what our subcommittee kind of had in mind when we contemplated this issue, and that is firm-level data. Richard's report has industry-level data. Industry-level data is not very helpful in terms of a competitive dynamic, but you could very, very easily imagine taking that industry-level data, for example, around firm partner credentials and dividing it up, right? Having each firm report what those credentials were for their firm as a whole. I think in what I now see as somewhat a naive way, I think that was kind of what we had in mind. One could imagine data, say, on restatements across an entire audit firm. I'm not suggesting necessarily that's what you want to do, but one could imagine that. That's one model. A second model is the model that really looks at these disclosures at an engagement level, and by the way, these models are not necessarily mutually exclusive. They're ways of conceptualizing how you would do this. So that data around an engagement would represent data around an audit firm would disclose to an audit committee and to the investors of that company, staffing levels for that engagement, something more detailed perhaps about fees, qualifications of the partners, that sort of thing. Engagement level disclosure, though, in aggregate across our public companies, turns into firm level disclosure, right? And it's a method by which you can then compare. Which an audit committee or investors could compare one engagement with another within an industry sector and within other types of measures of comparability, such as market cap or other measures of complexity. The third possibility is, I think, the possibility really envisioned by the FRC report. And the reason why I say there may be more concepts or structures here is because I didn't think of this one. I'm merely repeating what I've learned from Richard. And so there may be other models that haven't crossed my mind. This model is a model where a lot of the initiative is given to the firms themselves to define what they wish to disclose. But there is intensive interaction between a regulatory body, obviously in this context the PCAOB, and the firms in then shaping that disclosure. Not unlike, in a certain respect, some of the processes that go on under the 34 Act at the SEC. Now, one could mix and match these concepts, and the different types of metrics one could imagine disclosing in relationship to each model are fairly widespread. They're not infinite, but there's quite a few different possibilities within them. I will leave you with a couple of broad observations about how to think about this, and then I'm going to stop. I think people may be surprised. I'm not going to tell you what the right ones are. I really think that this is we need to do this collectively. First broad observation is that, as the staff documentation suggests, there is no dependent variable here anyone's been able to define. Say audit quality. What is that? What is that? If we were going to think about this in terms of independent variables and input variables and an output variable, what's the output variable? And rightly, it's been rightly identified that that output variable isn't, there isn't a number, right? Your audit quality is 7. I mean, that's not how it works. But there's nothing unique about this. Business success, right? I mean, is not definable by one number. There, in fact, is almost nothing of any real interest in life that's definable in that way by one number. Maybe height and weight. That doesn't mean, and that was not our, and that was not our intention in forwarding this recommendation, that somehow there's a holy grail out there that Mark and his staff will be able to identify and then force disclosure on. The idea is that there is data that is relevant, right? And that market actors here, coming back to concentration and competition, would want to have access to, and that would improve the general environment in which audit firms operate. So I think I can take the bold step of saying that the committee would reject the notion that because the dependent variable here is kind of a little hard to grab, that we shouldn't be looking for independent variables to have disclosure on. The second observation I'll make is that the committee was very aware, and I hope that in our discussions we are as well, that there is, to use a too often quoted phrase these days, that there can be unintended consequences around disclosure. And in particular that in a world where this principal agent problem, and audit selection and management has a principal agent problem rooted in it, which is that the management of the firm is deeply engaged in it, and their interests, management's interests and investor interests and the public interest and auditor's interests are all a little not entirely aligned with each other. There's also, and so you have to be thoughtful about what it is we want to disclose and the possibility of having the opposite effect that we wish to have. We believe this is why the investor ratification aspect of this is so important. We believe that any thought about the complexities here should take into account the positive impact we believe of having the investors involved as a backstop. That should either management or a management or an audit committee wish to sort of go down a road of weakening audit quality, as some people have been known to do, that there is a backstop here that would want that information and that would need that information to catch the backslide. The second point is that the committee was also very aware, because this was the concentration and competition committee, that we have to be concerned about impacts between large firms and smaller firms, and that thoughtfulness needs to be indulged in relation to unforeseen dynamics against the belief that the subcommittee, the full committee, the GAO, and a variety of other people have had, that we ought to be trying to move our audit our markets for auditing services toward a less concentrated state over time, so just as there's a principal agent problem, there's also a concentration issue here that has to be thought about carefully. So with that, I'll just repeat the key observation here, which is that one of the reasons why we did not have specific indicators in our report was because we believe that this group in its totality, the SAG, the board, the staff, actually possesses more information and more wisdom on this than the 5 or 6 of us did in our subcommittee. And so it's really a great pleasure to be able to hopefully learn from that. Thank you.
Thank you, Damon, for the additional color in connection with the background behind the recommendation, including the thinking as to why or why not to put in specific indicia of audit quality in the recommendation. We've put in a couple of the questions in the paper that we sent out of the briefing paper for purposes of this general discussion, which we'll have over the next 25 minutes or so. The first was whether a definition of audit quality is a prerequisite for developing meaningful indicators of audit quality, and if so, does anybody have any views on how that should be defined? So while that's the first question, I'd also say, you know, you've heard from Richard and Damon. I'd also say if you have any questions or comments on what you heard from them, please, now's the time to share that. So let's open the floor. And Joe, you're the first with a card up.
Yeah, I have a question for Damon. as it relates to your question up there, Marty, I think there are definitions. None of them are perfect. You put one up there, and I would agree with Damon's comment that I think there are independent variables that most people could agree are related to audit quality, regardless of how we define it. And trying to come up with a perfect definition, which I don't think we'd ever get, of audit quality shouldn't stop the board from moving forward. But I have a question for Damon. Damon, you laid out three models of audit quality metrics, firm-level data, engagement-level data, and then what you described as the FRC approach, firms decide what to disclose. And so here would be my question. I've read the two letters, I believe, from the same gentleman or lady, we don't even know the gender, I guess, that came to the ACAP. And if I recall correctly, one of the things that motivated this individual's suggestion was that he or she felt that it would the disclosure of these metrics would act as a prod to improve audit quality, which I thought was one of the more persuasive arguments in the letter. And if I recall correctly, this individual suggested that once these metrics were disclosed, whether they're engagement level or firm level, because as you said, you can roll up engagement level to firm level, that your friends in the financial press, the Wall Street Journal, the New York Times, Business Week, and so forth, will have a table with the four or the six or the eight firms on these metrics, just like you do now for universities. And it's amazing how it affects behavior. And the argument is that no managing partner would want to be last for very long. And that would drive major changes in behavior for the good. If you go with the third approach, Damon, you lose that, which I think is something very, at least it seems to me that you lose that, because unless all the firms decide to disclose the same thing, then that benefit's gone. The other thing I would ask you to comment on is you talked about this recommendation came out of the concentration and competition mandate. And if I recall aspects of the report, the argument I believe is made in the report is that some non-Big Four firms may be able to compete quite well on this, which would have the salutary benefit of increasing competition in the profession. But to the extent that, again, it's pick your own metrics, then it's harder for the audit committees and the investing public to compare firms against each other. So the benefit that you're talking about would not be achieved. At least it seems to me would be likely to not be achieved.
So let me start with the simple part of your question and come up with a more complex one. It was absolutely our view that this would create a level of playing field for competition between small and big firms. That the subcommittee felt quite strongly, and I think there's quite a bit of testimony at the hearings that the full committee held. To the effect that one of the barriers to entry to larger cap auditing, right, which is really the concentration and competition problem, is a kind of soft perception that the four largest firms are the only responsible choices, right? And expressing a preference among firms, I would say that having disclosures of some hard data across all firms would present an opportunity for smaller firms to make a case, right? Assuming that they had it. Now, secondly, I think that your point about which again is taken, I think, from the letters that we received and was the committee's view that what is measured is managed, right? We felt that if you had the right metrics disclosed, that they would definitely be managed to, right? Although there are issues about just the sort of the size of the audit market, particularly for large cap firms, and exactly how that would play out, but the feeling would be that those things would be managed to, and those numbers would both improve, and that firms would all be trying to avoid, as you say, being at the bottom. Now that's a double-edged sword, though. I mean, I think we need to acknowledge, and. If you pick the wrong thing to manage to, gross mortgage originations, for example, the outcome may not be what you want, right? And I think that feeling was part of why we deferred on picking, right? Now, as to the question of whether you'd have a different outcome from the FRC type model. I'm going to ask Richard to comment for a moment, although you didn't even address the question to him. I'll say this. I think from what I understand of the FRC model, one might, depending on the sort of culture that one operates in and the desires and capacity of the regulator, and I think one of the, you know, there are differences in national regulatory style, right? One could imagine a similar kind of roll-up thing coming out of the FRC model, but it would require a great deal of pretty aggressive involvement by the regulator, right, in shaping what those disclosures look like. And it would also depend on a certain amount of genuine, you know, a pretty intense genuine competitive dynamic among the firms so that, you know, I run my firm, I choose to disclose a certain set of metrics, then the other firms feel compelled to disclose the same. Right? I think that these are tactics to achieving the same goal. We in the United States have a long heritage of being somewhat skeptical on the regulatory front, at least outside maybe of banking, we'll see where that got us, really not relying upon those kinds of informal measures to force the disclosure, but rather, you know, having the regulator draw the table and then you fill in the numbers or action is taken. I think that the committee envisioned something of that nature. Right? When we envisioned this, we envisioned a kind of sort of simple notion that there's some metrics and then you have to disclose what those metrics are and everyone does the same. Right? Now, I think the regulatory style in the United Kingdom is different. And I think it has implications and it has roots in different market environments and a variety of different things. I'm going to leave it at that and ask Richard to fill in.
Thank you, Damon. I'll be brief because in some senses one of the key points has already been raised by Damon. But let me just try and draw out one point which we certainly do have in mind. And I'm interested that these proposal comes from the Competition and Choice Competition and Concentration Group, because actually one of the things we wanted to see happen, and hope to see happen, I should say, is that we wanted to see how firms tried to differentiate themselves and demonstrate that they really were delivering audit quality. Let me just give you two types of ways in which that might happen. It's certainly the case that one firm in the UK has a policy of focusing on the quality of the intake of the people that it takes into the firm from the outset. To take the, if I can put it this way, the Wall Street law firm model, they only take 5% from Harvard, Yale, New York, and Cornell, or wherever it happens to be. And one of their ways of measuring or demonstrating the quality of their work is to talk to the quality of the people that make up their staff. Another firm would probably argue that it has exceptionally good systems for bringing an audit to a conclusion with a process by which the audit issues are discussed, more people with experience are brought in to contribute to that, so that you get an opinion which has a real weight of experience in it, and so forth. Now, there are two different ways of trying to demonstrate to the market that you do something better than somebody else. And one of the things we wanted to do was, in the context of competition and choice, was to try and also encourage people to think about how they could differentiate themselves in a market which, frankly, is dominated by four firms that are perhaps practically indistinguishable to the average member of the public, or the investment community, for that matter. And so I think you need to see what the FRC was proposing in that context. You also need to, if I may say so, see it in the context where, going back to your comment about actual metrics and people having to do it, we have a corporate governance regime which has been in place now for nearly 20 years, which I don't think is disregarded by many, well, it's not disregarded in the UK, and it's reasonably well respected internationally, and yet it is a comply and explain model with absolutely no regime to enforce it whatsoever. But the investment community and the business community recognize that to depart from that is a decision of huge consequence. So I think you have to look at the FRC model in the context of what we were trying to achieve and also in the environment where people, frankly, had better comply or and step up to the plate, or, as I've tried to indicate, we will take it to another level. Does that help a little bit?
I think we have another question or comment from Chuck Noski.
Thank you. I guess my question is for Damon as well. I am concerned, and I know we'll get into this in the breakout groups, I am concerned about what quantitative measures get disclosed publicly, because I do agree that if they're measured, we will drive behavior and firms will optimize to those numbers, and I do worry about the unintended consequences of optimizing to numbers that may not necessarily be good predictors of audit quality or audit failure, so I think we need to be thoughtful about that. As the chair of two audit committees, I do agree that there is an information void in terms of what we get in order to make judgments about the performance of the firms. And so there is some information that I think perhaps not publicly disclosed, but routinely required to be reviewed by all audit committees would be appropriate. So I think we need to think about also public versus private disclosure and the information around there. But there's probably some level of public information that would be useful to everybody, and I think would be useful to investors as they consider their ratification decision. So I'm comfortable with that. I know one of the things we do use in my audit committees to talk about quality is the report from the PCAOB's examination, and we review that the part one of the document and to the extent that the PCAOB staff has identified accounting or auditing issues unique to a particular industry that might be the industry that our company is in, we really spend a lot of time probing the audit firm on whether or not that condition has any implications to our audit of our company. And I think that's useful. We also have been successful in extracting the content of the Part two, the private section from the audit firms, not necessarily in the level of detail I might like, but we do get a sense of it. I guess the question for Damon is, in your committee, did you give much consideration to what the role of the PCAOB's examination process might be in both the disclosure and the evaluation? Because what I worry about with the quantitative measures, we're talking about measuring quality with quantitative measures, and I am sort of from Missouri on that. And 20 years ago, when I was spending a lot of time in industry, we talked about the cost of quality and measuring the cost of quality in manufacturing and service businesses, and it was really, really hard. It was inconclusive in many cases. I will tell you, the amount of time and money we devoted to trying to figure it out was substantial, and I think we got better. But it may not get to the level, it may not necessarily achieve the objective that I think your committee would be encouraging the PCAOB to achieve. So be interested in your thoughts there.
Well, I think your comments are, I think, in line with certainly the thinking that led to this recommendation. In terms of the specific question, The committee thought that there was obviously, we believed, a great deal of knowledge resident here at the PCAOB and in the staff here. Some of it embodied in the part twos, and some of it perhaps not even written down. And that we wanted to see that knowledge deployed to help select the metrics. Right? That's a critical element of our view, that we were not going to tell the PCAOB what the metrics should be. We felt that they had the PCAOB has the information advantage, and we did not think that the potential that some, or the reality that some audit committees are able to extract some of that information, as you have been, was widespread enough to be or complete enough, as I think you indicated, to be a substitute for what we were considering. However, I don't think our view was that these types of disclosures of particular metrics would in any sense be sufficient in and of themselves to guide a decision maker, right? That we view them as supplementing the sorts of processes that you were describing that you go through already, in a context in which your observation about an information vacuum appears to be really surprisingly widespread among audit committees. As the only investor rep on the subcommittee, I learned a lot in a number of ways from the conversations we had about the difficulties of being on an audit committee in relationship to information by people who were clearly committed to that task on behalf of their firm and their investors, but yet felt underpowered. One would think that people in that position, who are the customer, after all, of the audit services and have the ability to withhold the contract, could get the information they need. It doesn't seem to be the case. The hard part is figuring out what is the right supplemental information. I am completely convinced that there is a body of data that it would be useful to have out there. I'm also convinced that you have to be thoughtful about what it is, because it will be managed to. Whatever we set out there, people will focus on it in the firms, not just in the firms, on the audit committees, among investors, and in the financial press. But I don't think that that's an argument for not doing it.
I know there are a few more cards up, and we'll get to those in a second. We posed a second question in the paper, but it's been touched on by both Damon and Richard, and that is whether audit quality indicators and effectiveness are really more feasible and more meaningful at either an individual audit engagement level or the auditing firm level as a whole, or maybe both, and you've talked about that a bit. But I just wanted to make sure you knew that question was being posed to this group also, or could be considered in the breakouts. Greg Jonas, I think you had your card up.
Well, let me address the previous question, Marty, that you had up there, which I think is should we go through the burdensome process of defining audit quality as a prerequisite to coming up with measures? First, I commend the Treasury Committee for teeing this whole issue up. I think this is very important, and it offers a chance to really help improve things. And so I'm a big fan of taking the time to do this. It strikes me that if the theory here is you manage what you measure, and we're all about coming up with measures, then you got to know where we're trying to take this thing. So I don't know how one can avoid deciding quite specifically what the heck we're trying to do. What is audit quality? I don't know how we avoid that. Otherwise, if you don't know where you're going, any road gets you there. So maybe it's stupid me. I didn't think it was all that hard because we know what the outputs of the audit process are. There are four of them. And we need to state what the quality objective is for each. And I think we got a vision of quality then, and then we go on to talk about how to measure it. No doubt I'm simplifying this greatly, but I thought I've done it, and I think given thought to it as a group here, I think we should take the time to do that.
Thanks, Greg. Tom Linsmeyer.
Responding to your first question, not as an FASB board member, but more as a former academic, I don't know how you could possibly avoid, if you're going to do this well, like Greg, I think you absolutely have to define a measure of audit quality. Because absent that measure, any independent variable that is reported as an indicator is a whim. You don't know whether it is really distinguishes the quality or not. Is it a discriminating variable? Is it something that's correlated with something that matters or doesn't? What are the key factors that really drive audit quality? And without defining audit quality, I don't know that you can remotely come up with anything to report. that would be meaningful and not have a great deal of unintended consequences. I think voluntarily letting the firms come up with measures to distinguish themselves, they will find ways to distinguish themselves in those numbers, but I don't know that there will be anything meaningful in the numbers that they come forward with. So I agree with Joe's comments. I think there has to be some sort of required reporting that's common across the firms to have this be meaningful at all. But to move forward, I think it's absolutely imperative to come up with some sort of judgment as to what quality is. And I think you're actually asking the right group, but we are at a hugely comparative disadvantage to the PCAOB. The PCAOB is running an inspection program. There must be something underlying that inspection program that's driving your view of what you inspect, what you pay attention to be able to assess what quality is or not in that inspection program. And then once you have that information, what is your distinguishing characteristics, you also have access to data that no one else has. And so I find it a disadvantage to start with looking at all academic research or looking at what the GAO has said previously, because those particular studies have been constrained by publicly available information that is a subset of what the PCAOB has access to. And so in some respects, I think the conversation would be better informed if the PCAOB would come forward with some thought processes as to what they're thinking about in terms of quality, both strengths and weaknesses of the measures they're looking at, because it's clearly a multiple attribute measure. I don't think it's only one. Greg thinks there's four. I suspect if we started talking, it would explode quickly beyond four in trying to come up with it. But I don't know that getting reactions from us, given your comparative advantage, is exactly the right starting point. I think the better starting point is to understand what you've understood and revealed in your inspection process, put forward some quality measures, and then think about what might be the independent variables tied to quality and actually run some statistical analysis to see what's discriminatory in being able to identify that. All of that might work just internally. The next question is there any value to disclosing those externally? If those measures of correlation are really rather weak, I don't know that they're rather discriminatory and sufficient to be disclosed publicly. Some observations.
Thanks, Tom. Lynn Turner?
I'd just like to echo what Greg said. People already manage a lot by the numbers. I don't know why people are worried about putting numbers out there. People manage to, each of the firms managed numbers anyway. They manage to a budget number for revenue each year, labor cost as a percent of revenues, partner contributions, rate per hour is the number of billable hours that each partner is responsible for. They already got those out there, and they're always already managing to them. So the fact that someone would say, well, let's actually manage something that relates to audit quality only seems to be common sense and not rocket scientist. Tom's probably right. I think you probably ought to come up with some definition of audit quality, but I wouldn't turn this into a rocket scientist exercise. I think it's very simple. Are the numbers accurate at the end of the day? Do they come to me accurate as an investor? And two, are their communications to investors and the audit committees complete and timely and robust enough? And I think the last part is very important, as is the first part. So I think it's very doable. I think it's got to be specific, definable things. And I think it's good that people actually manage the quality.
Marty, can I get just a word here, unless there's other people waiting?
Please do.
I want to, in light of the past group of comments, I want to emphasize a couple of things I said in passing earlier. The first is that the three models of how to do this that I've set forward are not mutually exclusive. Right. If I think that's important. Right. The second is that put some precision on this issue of defining audit quality. It's clearly possible to write a narrative description of audit quality. I don't know whether it's a 4-point description as Greg suggests, I'm sure I've seen one that's one sentence in relation to the accuracy of financial statements. I've
you can obviously make a much longer one, and the longer you get, the more nuanced and so forth. I think what is, and so having that in mind, having some narrative description of what it is we're trying to achieve is probably not a bad idea at all. But I think that trying to reduce that to a regression analysis, which is why I talked about very dependent and independent variables, I think that trying to making a valid regression analysis the prerequisite of action here is going to be a recipe for doing nothing. Because it's not possible, I believe, to take that narrative description, which you can construct, and turn it into a number. Right? That's why when I talk about the number 7, right? It's just you can't go from one to the other, and therefore you can't make that type of analysis and the types of regressions that you would then run to determine what's a meaningful contributing variable. It's a recipe for a dead end, right? And if I don't think there's anything particularly unique about audit quality in that respect. I think that is a set of circumstances analytically that exists in a lot of other places in our economy and our society, where, as Lynn puts it, numbers are nonetheless disclosed and managed to. And so I would hope that while the board is focused. Right, on having some concept of audit quality that we are trying to get to, that we not put these, I think, inappropriate analytic prerequisites in front of us before acting. Certainly I think that would be the committee's wish.
Thanks, Damon. We are about at the end of this session. We're going to take a short break till around 3:30 or so. On the board right here are the breakout groups, Group A, B, and C. Bella, does everybody have these sheets elsewhere? I'm going to turn this over to Bella in 1 second. Group A, we're asking to consider the questions that are in the briefing paper from the perspective of investors' needs. What's the feasibility of audit quality indicators, and what's the need from an investor's point of view for audit quality indicators and measures? From Group B, from an issuer's point of view, what does an audit committee have, need, want, with respect to audit quality indicators, and try to come at the question from that point of view? And from Group C, from an auditor's point of view, what would auditors think about the audit quality indicators and unintended consequences, which comes up often in terms of discussion here, and also the usefulness of such indicators in their view. So that's what we're asking you to do. It's the first time we've gone to breakout sessions in the group, and we're looking forward to those meetings. Tomorrow morning we'll come back here in the chairs of each of those breakout sessions. We'll take about 15 minutes each to kind of summarize the thoughts of their breakout group, and then we'll have another half-hour discussion to kind of wrap this topic up. Bella, did you want to add anything further?
For those individuals that will be participating in the breakout group discussions, the breakout group discussions are going to take place upstairs, so directly above us. There's also refreshments and more snacks up there, so you don't have to try to balance everything as you're going upstairs. And please let me know if you have any questions. And as Marty said, for those that are not going to be participating in the breakout sessions, there will be a summary tomorrow morning starting at 9 a.m. And this concludes this portion of the meeting. Thank you.